If you ask a stupid question, you get a stupid answer, right?
These are steps we all must take to protect Scotland.
The people of Scotland will not be disrespected by this Parliament. Mr. Speaker.
Have you ever had a boss who bullied or sexually harassed you, or who ignored your complaint when another member of staff did? How about one who faked your payslips and kept your tax contributions for themselves? Or who rejected your request for leave while your mother was dying? Or while you were having a mental health crisis? Who wouldn't turn up the heating when the office was freezing? A boss who paid you less than your colleagues and then said you weren't a team player when you complained? One who refused you shifts and then fired you for not working enough hours? Who demanded you arrive 10 minutes early and penalized you for leaving on time, despite paying you below minimum wage and by the hour? Who sacked you after 7 years of service in the midst of a global pandemic? Who paid you so little you had to claim benefits and use food banks? Who put you under so much pressure you drove your car into a tree in an attempt to take your own life? If you answered yes to even just one of these questions, this episode is for you. Hi everyone, and welcome back to Scottish Politics Explained. My name is Iris, and the words you just heard are from Make Bosses Pay, a book written by Eve Livingston and published by Pluto Press. This is the start of our second season, and for the first episode, amid furlough ending, universal credit cuts, and energy prices going up, what better topic to start with than workers' rights? Today, in fact, I have the pleasure of chatting to Eve Livingston, author of the book I have just mentioned, to explore the world of unions and why young workers should engage with them. So hi, Eve, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Do you want to maybe start by, you know, just introducing yourself? I know you're a freelance journalist. You've done loads of different things. Why don't we start by finding out a bit more about you and your work?
Yeah, so like you say, I'm a freelance journalist usually, and I cover kind of social affairs and inequalities. So as part of that, I've covered a lot of workplace kind of stories and workplace conflicts and kind of trade union actions to try and solve those, because they are a big part of the story of inequality in this country, I think. When it came time to write the book, I was approached to write it. I was asked by the publisher if I would write a book for the Outspoken series at Pluto Press, which is kind of targeted at young readers. And it's, you know, books exploring various different kind of political themes. And so I really quickly landed on unions as the topic I should write about, for exactly that reason, that it seemed so central to the kind of conversation about inequality and making things fairer and better. So the book is called Make Bosses Pay, and it's just come out. And it is that, it's a book kind of for younger readers who maybe are a bit union curious, or maybe have never heard of a union before, or maybe are already involved in a union and are kind of frustrated and want to change things within their unions. Because the book is certainly not trying to say that the union movement is kind of perfect as it stands. It makes a lot of cases for improving things. So yeah, that's what the book is really. It's about why young people should be in unions, but how those unions need to change and adapt to meet the needs of those new members.
And do you have like kind of your own experience with unions? Have you ever been involved?
Yeah, I mean, I come from a family, and I think this is how most or many young people at least do get involved in unions, as if their family have been union members, and so they grow up kind of hearing about unions. So I come from a family like that, where unions have just been part of life. And so I joined one as soon as I got into work, because for me that was just something you did. It was kind of as immediate as any other, you know, part of starting work. So yeah, I've always been in a union. I had kind of mixed experiences. I've definitely had the experience, I talk about this in the book, of, you know, being the kind of only young woman in the room, or being sort of overlooked because of that, you know, it being presumed that I wouldn't be interested in the union, or that I wouldn't have any knowledge about unions or what they do. So yeah, so that kind of informs the book, I suppose. And what I hope the book sort of serves as is almost a message to diverse young workers and marginalized young workers to say unions are also your space, you know, and this is how we should reimagine them to make sure that can be true.
You mentioned your target audience there, which, if I remember correctly, is of people from 18 to 35 years old. So basically kind of the same audience of this podcast. And I was wondering, you know, if you had to talk to a young worker, or like, for example, we have a few listeners who are from other countries and have moved here to Scotland. So maybe, you know, they're not used to unions as they are in the UK or in Scotland specifically. If you had to describe what a union is and what unions do, how would you do it?
Yeah, so first of all, the way that I would describe what a union is possibly different than the kind of popular understanding of a union. So I think a lot of people probably understand a union as an organisation that is separate from the kind of workforce and that will come in and sort of solve your problems for you if you're having trouble at work. So, you know, you're having a problem with your boss, you go to the union, they sort of sweep in, do a bit of mediation, sort it out, and then sweep out again. I make the case in the book that people should think of unions as being a sort of active commitment between people. So there's no such thing as a union without any members. And so to me, I think it is really worth thinking of a union as its members and as the kind of commitment that they make to each other to act collectively in their shared interests. So so essentially, you know, it's about kind of protecting your rights at work and making sure that you are being treated fairly and having a good time at work, and your union membership can kind of protect those things and make sure that they're happening. But it's also, when you think of it in those terms of being kind of a commitment that people make to each other, it's also got, I think, endless potential. You know, unions have the potential to be really active in wider society, sort of changing the conversation about inequality and making things better by being the voice of ordinary people in society at large.
I agree, but as you say, unions are a commitment. So looking at them from a more practical perspective, why should a young person commit in the first place? Because of course, you know, they could be a working student, for example, like this imaginary person is a working student. So why should they use their free time to join a union?
Well, first of all, I think that that sort of collective action is the only thing that's ever changed anything. Our bosses and our the kind of governments and things in this country are doing collective action all the time. You know, they're banding together and they're acting in their interests as kind of wealthy people who own businesses and who make laws. And so the only kind of way to balance that out is for ordinary people, you know, just normal people with jobs, to also work together and to have that collective voice. So, you know, I'm not saying it's a kind of easy thing to do, because the case that I make in the book is that your union membership is an active thing. So I'm calling for people to join unions and to get involved, and as you say, to put in time to do that and put in kind of money also, because you know you have to pay to be a member of a union. So I understand that that is something that people need to think carefully about, and it's a big commitment that they might be making. But I do just think the potential is huge. I think the potential for people working together to be able to actively change things, whether that's just in your own individual workplace, you know, whether it's taking on your boss to be able to keep your tips, say if you work in a restaurant, that might be something you can make happen as a collective. Or it could be, you know, bigger than that. It could be about sort of changing laws or challenging bad decisions that governments make. So the potential is endless. So yes, it's a bit of a commitment for people, but the kind of chances that you have to change things are huge once you commit.
Talking about change, what are some of the union campaigns that struck you the most, or you know, that you think that they are particularly important, especially if they're being led by young people?
Yeah, I think one really good example, which I talk about in the book, which is also Scotland-based, is the campaign Better Than Zero, which is backed by the STUC, so it is a union-backed campaign, but it slightly differs from kind of traditional unions in that it's much more sort of responsive and fast-acting. So what Better Than Zero do a lot of the time is that they're really active on social media. So quite often a worker will kind of message them on Facebook and say, you know, I work in such and such restaurant in town. And to use that example again, my boss is keeping all our tips and we're not getting any of them. And Better Than Zero are able to kind of quite quickly respond to that worker, say, do you have any other colleagues that are unhappy about this that could join this kind of campaign? And then they do things like, you know, they might name and shame the restaurant on social media. They might go to the restaurant and have a kind of protest outside it. They also do the traditional stuff of negotiating with the bosses and kind of doing that side of support. But I think theirs is a really inspiring model for young people in Scotland, because what it means, I think, essentially, is that hospitality workers all across Scotland kind of know that if something goes bad and if they have a bad experience at work, there is this organization that's just sitting there on the other end of, you know, Facebook Messenger or Twitter who will kind of have their back. So I think that's a very instructive example of kind of recent, you know, trade union activity that's very relevant to young people's life.
Yeah, definitely. But also I wanted to ask you, with the emerging of, you know, new ways of working from the gig economy to the various forms of freelancing, you're a freelance journalist, so you probably have an idea of how these new forms of work are kind of isolating workers. For this reason, I would imagine it's a bit more difficult to join a union because you might not even know how to access one or what is your relevant one. So from the worker in a call center to the freelance journalist, how does a person actually find and then join a union? How do you find your relevant one, and how, let's say, how accessible are they also in terms of money?
Yeah, so the picture is quite patchy across different workplaces. So there will be certain workplaces and certain sectors where unions are already really active and have a lot of members. And in a lot of those cases, that means that the workplace will recognise a union already. So they've in that case made an agreement to negotiate with the union as the kind of representative of their workers. So you will find that in a lot of jobs, and particularly in the public sector, you'll find probably that your workplace already recognises a union. And certainly, if that's the case for you, that should be the union you should join, as the one that's recognised, because they're able to then act on your behalf. They've already made that agreement. In workplaces where you don't have a union that recognises, that the employer recognises, which will be a lot of these kind of newer type of jobs that you're talking about. So, you know, couriers, for instance, people working via apps, but also sectors like hospitality and retail that haven't traditionally had union presences because they've been much smaller historically than they are today. In those kinds of workplaces, I think the first place you should start is to find out if your colleagues are in a union. And if there's an obvious union that most of your colleagues are already in, then you should join that one, because then they have a bigger presence in the workforce, and then you're able to go to that union, to the, you know, representative for your area, and say to them, there's 10 of us in this workplace that are all members. Would you be able to come in and help us be recognised by the employer? And if you're in a workplace that doesn't recognise the union and none of your colleagues are in a union, or you don't want to ask them about it, that's the most difficult position of all. And actually, in those cases, it might fall to you to figure out which union to join, and to try and talk to your colleagues about getting them to join also. So that's the biggest task. But you can quite easily find that information online. So the TUC, for instance, has a union finder tool where you can do a sort of flow chart to tell them what your job is and what your sector is, and they'll present you with the unions that you're eligible to join. There are also some unions that aren't affiliated to the TUC, so they won't show up on that finder. Some of the newer kind of unions that are operating in the gig economy, for instance, Independent Workers of Great Britain and United Voices of the World, but they will come up if you kind of search, either just a Google search, or if you search for news about kind of strikes in your sector, you know, hospitality workers on strike or being represented by a union. And then, yeah, it would be a case of joining the union that you think kind of best meets your needs and that you're eligible to join, and getting some support from that union about, you know, from the reps there, about how to kind of have a conversation with your colleagues about them also becoming members and maybe working towards that recognition. But that's certainly the hardest position to be in. So, you know, it's challenging for people to do that. But as I kind of said earlier, I think it's absolutely worth it if you're willing to kind of be the person that starts those conversations. But as soon as you join a union, then you'll be able to turn to the kind of representatives in your area or for your sector for this kind of guidance about how to have those conversations. So you immediately get access to that resource.
See, starting those conversations can be quite challenging, I think, because another fear young but also kind of not so young workers have is that of being treated differently by, you know, either co-workers or their bosses because they mentioned unionizing. So what would be your advice to those who are worried about the potential consequences of joining a union?
Yeah, I mean, those fears aren't unfounded. It's true that people have been historically kind of targeted by their bosses, or, you know, the blacklisting is a term for where kind of people are either unfairly sacked or kind of unfairly treated in the workplace because they're active union members. So, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to happen for the law to protect people better, but people should be reassured that the law as it stands, does protect your right to be a member of a union. So on paper, you cannot be discriminated against for union membership. If that happens to someone, then again, your union itself is probably the best place to advise, because they have access to, you know, legal support and all of that kind of thing, who can come in and support you if that does happen to you. So yeah, so on the very kind of logistical stuff, that's the process you would go through. But I would say, in terms of your co-workers, certainly the people that I've kind of spoken to in researching the book, many of them have had that fear that their co-workers would kind of judge them for being in a union. And actually, you know, I can't speak to every workplace in the country, but certainly the people I spoke to, that didn't happen for them. It didn't, their fears were unrealized, because when they started to talk to their co-workers and say, you know, are you also quite annoyed that the boss keeps our tips when we are the ones who've earned them? Their co-workers would say to them, yeah, I am actually. It does really annoy me. I also find that very frustrating. And then, you know, you can start to say, well, actually, there might be a way that we could change that. And that's slightly different than just kind of going in all guns blazing and saying, like, you know, the union has arrived. So I think when you have conversations in that way, actually people aren't really hostile to unions. The research doesn't show that young people are particularly hostile to unions. It suggests more that they kind of have a lack of knowledge about them, and that when they do kind of find out more about what they do, they're actually very warm to the idea of a union, but they need to be told essentially what unions are and what they do and why they should join. And then I think people often find that they're kind of knocking on an open door once they do that.
And I think also one key element, as you said, is language. You don't want to scare people off with big words, you know, kind of, yeah, we should unionize and do this and that and become socialists, but just, you know, start from something real, as you mentioned, tips, for example. But I mean, especially because workers are from all kinds of walks of life, or you never know how much a person knows about a determined issue, and they shouldn't feel excluded on that basis. So connected to this, I wanted to ask you about vocabulary. Are there any important phrases or words we should know the meaning of? So for example, in your book, you talk about collective bargaining and class consciousness. What would you say are the most important things we need to keep in mind?
Yeah, so I think this is a really good question, because I think we can start to kind of talk in jargon, and that can be one of the things that people find off-putting. I think one of the important phrases is union recognition, which we've discussed already. So, you know, that a union recognition agreement would be where an employer has made a formal agreement with a union to negotiate with them on behalf of their workers. And that's important for people to know about, because as I just mentioned, that should be your first port of call when you're looking to join a union, is to find out if one of those exists in your workplace. Collective bargaining, as you've highlighted there, does sound like quite a kind of complicated word, I think, but actually it's sort of one of the central things that people think of when they think of unions, because it is essentially just the act of doing that, of negotiating on behalf of the workforce with an employer. So the collective part refers to the union being able to speak for a number of different employees at once. And the bargaining part refers to that negotiation. So in a workplace, if there's a conflict emerges, the union representatives will sit down with the employer's representatives and they'll say, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of the whole of the unionized workforce, and what I say kind of is their voice also. So that's what collective bargaining is. You mentioned class consciousness as well, which I think is probably used less in sort of day-to-day union activities, but it's something that I think is particularly important, and it's something that I think unions should be putting kind of at the centre of their work. And what I mean by class consciousness is a sort of recognition that a person has of their sort of place in society and how society operates. And I don't mean their place in society, you know, like the bottom of the pile, but I mean having a recognition of the structures that we exist in, and recognizing that there is a kind of working class who are kind of at the beck and call of the sort of ruling class, or the boss class, if you like. So being able to situate yourself within the structures of society, and to see that you're not just kind of one person alone who's being, you know, picked on by a bad apple boss, but that actually the way that work is structured under capitalism is always going to be that dynamic. So it's not really about you. It's about kind of how class works and how capitalism works. And so that's what I mean by class consciousness, is people kind of coming to realize where they fit in amongst that structure. And I think when you start to realize that, you start to realize that, as I said earlier, this kind of collective action is the only way to challenge that structure. So that's I think important, and it's something that unions should be doing, is trying to kind of be the place where people come to that realization. So yeah, I think they're pretty good terms for people to get started with. I don't know if there's any others that you, I mean, I suppose one of the things that people talk about is union reps, you know, which when you think about it is actually relatively self-explanatory, because it's just short for a representative, and it just means the person who is kind of either your rep in the workplace or your rep in a sort of geographical region. But sometimes I think we talk about union reps as if they're kind of like really separate from us, like a sort of abstract thing, or like kind of intimidating, like they represent the union and you just represent like your one workplace. So I think it's helpful for people just to think of that in a very kind of literal way of like, you know, they are the representative of the union for you. They're the kind of first port of call for you when you have a question for the union or something that you need a bit of help with. But I mean, you know, there's lots of other words that come up around unions, about strikes and industrial action, which kind of refers to a variety of different tactics that unions might use to take action on kind of workplace issues. But I think they, you know, once you start to be involved in unions, you kind of start to just, you'll kind of naturally come to learn what those sorts of things are. So yeah, if someone's sort of intimidated about joining a union because of this jargon or whatever, then they should definitely just kind of spend, you know, 10 minutes looking through like the TUC website or some news stories about union actions, for instance. And I think they'd quite quickly come to realise that they're just technical words for things that are quite kind of easy to get to grips with.
So I think we've covered everything I had in mind for this episode, but is there anything I haven't asked you that you would like to stress or highlight?
I don't think so. I think that's been a really good conversation. Just that, you know, I hope that the book is relevant to kind of precisely the listeners of this program. It's kind of exactly the people I had in mind really when I was writing it, were people who are sort of politically engaged but maybe want to find out a bit more about the union movement, or as I said at the top of the recording, maybe they are involved but they want to kind of push for things to be a bit different or a bit better. So yeah, I really hope that your listeners might get something out of it.
I'm sure they will. Personally, I really loved it, but we should also maybe add where they can find it.
Yeah, well, it's out now, so it is available to buy. You can buy directly from the publisher, which is Pluto Press, or you can either find it in your local bookshop or get it ordered into your local bookshop. And you can also get it from the major retailers too, but I like to do a kind of bit of support for smaller independent local shops.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Eve, for talking to me. It's been lovely.
Thank you. It's been a great conversation.
This was the first episode of the new season of Scottish Politics Explained. If you wish to buy Eve's book, you'll find all the info in the description of the episode, along with a link to support the podcast. You can follow Scottish Politics Explained on Instagram and Twitter at @ScottPolPodcast, and you can find all the complete transcripts of our episodes at scottishpoliticsexplained.wordpress.com. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week.